Stick to Wrestling. It is a lifestyle, not just a podcast, and it's the only wicked good pro wrestling podcast. I am here with Sean Goodwin. Sean, how are you tonight?
I have no idea what you just said. Anyway, so this is our special. Well, to start, I should say one thing. Because of, you know, we've been having some success, so I decided to spring my own dime, mind you, on a brand spanking new headset. So if you hear, we're kind of working it out right now. So if there are any problems, it's entirely my fault. Because like I said, we figured we'd try something new, try to improve the audio a little bit. So I am working off a headset for the first time. Yes, I was that guy in the corner with the phone to my ear with the, you know, what was the, remember the mile long cord from the base to the old phones back then? That was me doing the show before now. So we're going high tech.
There we go. And you know what? A room is never messier than when you're in the middle of cleaning it. So, I mean, this is the first time we've tried it, but we're going to get there. I'm not worried about it. But we are recording this the night before Thanksgiving. And, Sean, I don't know if you're aware of this. The second and third biggest party nights in the United States are Thanksgiving night and the night before Thanksgiving, in that order.
Yes, back in my old drinking days, we used to call those amateur hours. Yeah, that is basically when everyone comes home and decides to act just completely insane for, that was always one circled in the calendar as one to, be careful on.
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, Wednesday night, no one's got to be at work the next day. Thanksgiving dinner is usually not until 2 o'clock at the earliest for most people.
Sure.
And then Thanksgiving night was always a big party around here.
Sure, you have the big hangover and whatever, but see, this is one thing. So we are doing the Thanksgiving show, and that is one thing I want to address is the thing. Our concept of Thanksgiving wrestling, we never understood that until we started to meet Southern wrestling fans and watch Southern wrestling, because up in the Northeast, Thanksgiving means high school football in the morning, and that's pretty much it.
Yeah, high school football in the morning, you know, and then the Cowboys and the Redskins on, or the Cowboys and the Lions on TV in the background during the day, and that's pretty much it. Like, we didn't have, you know, I guess if you live in Dallas, like, going to see the Cowboys is part of Thanksgiving for, what, 60,000 people or whatever it is, but up here, it's, you know, it's completely clear. Off the subject a little bit, when I lived in New York, like, there wasn't high school football in New York. No one cared. And it's a huge deal up here.
Yeah. I mean, okay. So for those who aren't from the area, this is your standard Boston, Irish Boston Thanksgiving. Okay. You woke up just like to shave your tongue. I mean, it's just, it's a bad one. Okay. So you wake up at 9, depending on what kind of condition you're in, maybe you'll go back to bed again, or the college football games are usually at 11, I mean, which is just demonic, but they were usually
that's
around
gone.
11 o'clock, so that's
no
gone.
No more Texas A&M at 11 o'clock, it's just the Colorado State and Air Force, and then Thursday night is the Egg Bowl, Mississippi State and Ole Miss.
You have such a one-track mind. I'm at the high school games.
Oh, okay.
Locally. Right to college football, always.
I thought that's what you said.
So you get back, all the family gathers. This is probably around 1 or 2. The arguing starts soon after that.
Yeah.
There was 5 minutes of peace and quiet. The arguments are basically from 1:05 until no one can take it anymore, and everyone goes off on their merry way to, you know, whatever bar happens to be open or club or whatever. Mm-hmm. So there's your, you know, not exactly Norman Rockwell, I grant, but that's how we roll here. Now, from what I understand, down south, it's an entirely different thing.
Yeah, Thanksgiving is, you know, not anymore, but Thanksgiving used to be a big wrestling day in the Carolinas, in Dallas, New Orleans, I believe, a few other places.
Certainly in the I just had it up too. Certainly in the Carolinas, you're going back to from even before Starcade was in Greensboro. They had that Thanksgiving event for what, into the 60s?
I believe like mid 60s until they moved Starcade to Chicago in 87.
Yep, I'm looking at the first one now. It was in Norfolk, Virginia, 1967. Gene, I'm going off the Mid-Atlantic Gateway. Those fine folks. Gene Kniski against Weaver. I believe Kniski was the champ at the time. So that was like your big card. You would have the guy at Georgia. It was comical. Georgia would – somebody would lose the title or have it stripped right before Thanksgiving.
Mm-hmm.
Every year. I mean, it was like the coin flip for war games. You know, you knew so if you had the title in November, you were about to drop the title, the tag team titles, because there was a tag team title tournament every year.
That's right. They did that in Atlanta, too. I forgot Atlanta had a big Thanksgiving tradition wrestling-wise.
Yeah, that was it. It was because I remember I was watching 1981. You were nice enough to send those to me. And I was watching 81, and I was getting ready for it, and they lost the tag team title. They just conveniently had the tournament. Everybody came in. It was that, you know, the way Georgia did it, which was like, you know, the Asian states and, you know, the Antarctica team, whatever.
Oh, yeah.
And they just have, that was their big event. And even, you know, I guess World Class did it too, but it was – they seemed to have like Star Wars for Arbor Day. So, I mean, it was like every holiday Fritz could roll out Star Wars, he would. So, where else was it big?
Oh, let me see. I mean, I would say once again, you know, biggest was the Carolinas. I mean, they had Thanksgiving shows before Starcade, as you alluded to. World Class always had a big Thanksgiving show. I think New Orleans did it too. And this, you know, just to underline, I mean, this is really unusual for us, because I think the WWF gave their wrestlers, I don't think they worked on Thanksgiving until Vince went national.
The only reason they worked on Thanksgiving was because they had a counter Starcade.
Well,
so that's why they came up with
before,
the Survivor Series.
Right, but I mean, again, that was after Vince went national, and there's a long story on that, which we'll tell today. But one of the I don't want to say wildest, but one of the craziest weekends I had wrestling-wise was – I wish we had done this last year, except the podcast didn't exist. But 1987, I had a crazy Thanksgiving wrestling weekend. We drove down, up and down, from, you know, Nashua, New Hampshire, to the Long Island Coliseum to see Crockett, the day before Thanksgiving. And it took us, we wanted to leave at 10. We wound up leaving at 11. We wanted to try to beat New York traffic. That did not happen. And we got to the arena. The show started at 8, and we didn't get to the arena until like 7:15. And we just stopped at like a McDonald's to grab something to eat in the car. So that's an awfully long trip to see a show.
Okay, so you sent me an email earlier with three cards. Now I'm starting to figure out what they meant. So the first card was the Wednesday card, Long Island, Nassau Coliseum, November 25th, 1987, JCP.
Mm-hmm.
And this is their first time. Where else in the Northeast had they been at this point?
I think that was the – oh, wait a minute. No, I take that back. They had already been to Boston in April of 1987, but I believe that's it. They had never been to New York before. They'd been to the – well, yeah, Crockett, I don't think he'd ever gone to the Meadowlands by himself.
I was going to say – I was going to say, had he gone to the Meadowlands? Because I thought Ricky and Flair were in the Meadowlands.
They were, but that wasn't just a JCP card. I mean, they had a lot of what is it, that Vern Gagne show that was on WPIX, that they had shows based on that, but that wasn't just Crockett, even though Crockett sent his guys in to New Jersey in like 85 and 86. But I don't think JCP itself, they stopped doing that by 87, and I'm almost positive Crockett never ran the medal, had not run the Meadowlands at this point.
Okay, so I just thought of a fun little thing we can do. But tell the story about this card.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. Can you read the results to our listeners?
Sure. We jerking the curtain. We have Sting and Ron Simmons against UFW TV champ Terry Taylor, who was fantastic at this point, and the Barbarian to a draw.
Yeah, at this point, Sting was not getting pushed yet. He was just another guy on the show. Pretty much same thing with Ron Simmons. And I agree with you with Terry Taylor. He looked phenomenal at this point, but Dusty just didn't like him. And, you know, Terry Taylor and the Barbarian, what? You know?
Dusty may have done more damage to him in 2 years than Vince ever did with that stupid rooster gimmick.
No, I'm not sure about that. I mean, Dusty did not do him any favors.
Terry was on the cusp of stardom until Dusty got his hands on him.
I'll say something that's like way out there, but it's something I really believe. Had they pushed Terry Taylor right, he could have been NWA champion and replaced Ric Flair in the Horsemen. And I know a lot of people are not going to agree with that, but I really think it.
If the oil companies didn't go down and he stays alive, and Mid-South stays alive, and Bill goes national, there's your lead babyface.
Well, they were going to make him their lead heel, or at least one of their top heels, when Watts finally sold the company. Taylor's like in the middle of a heel turn against Chris Adams when that happened.
Which seems odd, but you'd think you'd do the opposite. But okay, so next we have Larry Zbysko against Kevin Sullivan. Any recognition whatsoever? Because both of these guys probably wrestled here with WWF.
Oh, they definitely did. They were both babyfaces at the time. At this point, Sullivan was the babyface. He went through this weird thing where he was just a babyface in Florida, and that reflected on TBS. And I think in January 1988, we're about 6 weeks away from another heel turn by Sullivan. It wasn't even a turn. He showed up as the master or the head of the varsity club.
Yeah, up there in history as the most unsympathetic baby face ever. Right there with Ole Anderson, who retired the position.
yeah, I agree with you.
Okay, now this is the match that got me thinking. Because what I was going to do after we're done talking about your personal experience there is that if you're coming up to the Northeast for the first time, how would you book it? Because we knew what the product was and what they liked. So I was thinking maybe after we're done this, we rebook this card for a Northeast audience.
Okay.
But let me get on to the personal observations. Jimmy Valiant, Bugsy McGraw, and Mighty Buddy Wilbur. Good Lord.
Whoa.
That may be the worst six-man tag team I have ever seen. That is horrible. I mean, Buddy McGraw is... Does Useless even summon up at this point?
I would probably not. There was a time where I liked Bugsy McGraw, but by this point, like he didn't even have that charisma anymore. He was I don't know what they were doing with him.
In the right spot, and you know, for a brief period of time, Bugsy could be effective. This was like in the early '80s, late '70s, maybe before then. Mm-hmm. By '80s, this guy's toast by '87. Yep. So against Black Bart, the Warlord, and Ivan Koloff. Okay. Here's your problem. How old's Ivan here?
Ivan is, he's got to be close to 50.
He's your best worker, and it's not close.
It's not even close. Black Bart actually wasn't that bad, but Ivan was way better than Bart.
50-year-old Ivan Koloff is your best worker in the match. How bad was that match?
I remember the only thing, I vaguely remember the only thing saving it is that they kept it relatively short.
Okay, we have Michael Hayes and Jimmy Garvin in the really, really bad version of the Freebirds.
They weren't that bad by this point. They were going to get bad really quickly, like when they came back in early 89. But they weren't terrible at this point.
They were the least intimidating tag team of all time.
They were baby chasers.
I know, but still, I mean, there was nothing. Nothing. There was like... The idea of – you could not picture – it just didn't look real. I mean, that's why you had Gordy there. Gordy was an enforcer while Michael flapped his gums. Garvin isn't an enforcer, and it didn't work. You had two guys in the same role together. The team made no sense.
Well, yeah, I can see that. I mean, Hayes was still a very effective babyface at this point. Once again, that was going to be gone in like 18 months. But Hayes was fine, and Jimmy was like the little brother.
But that's the problem, though. They were both doing the same thing. It makes no sense to have a tag team. I mean, if you're going to have a good tag team, you want some guy, you know, who is maybe the high fly, like the Kangaroos. You had one guy the high flyer, the other guy did the ground game. Or you have the muscle guy and the fast guy. You have two guys to do the exact same thing.
Well, you know what? Right after this, Michael Hayes was – he went around the horn against Ric Flair – you know, in the babyface role, and there was, you know, no one said, oh, wow, he'll never win the NWA title. We need a better challenger for Flair. You know, everyone was fine with it.
I just – and who are the Jive Tones?
Oh, God. One of my friends, his name is Ricardo Coleman. He's actually my first internet friend, and he's an African-American. And earlier this week, he was openly wondering what a Jive Tone was, and no one has an answer. But the Jive Tones were Pez Whatley and Tiger Conway Jr. doing a gimmick where they were wearing top hats and dinner jackets to the ring, and they were just another two guys hanging around on the card.
Wasn't the Jive Tones one of the bands in the original Blues Brothers movie? Wasn't like the Murph and the Murph Tone? It was like one of the bands.
Murph and the Magic Tones.
There was another band in there. I thought it was called the Jive Tones or something like that. Anyway, I'm going off track. UFW champion Steve Williams over Rick Steiner. Now that looks fun.
Well, Rick Steiner had not. He was just another guy in Eddie Gilbert's stable, but he looked like he had a lot of potential. I remember this match being disappointing, to say the least, because, you know, I liked Doc and Steiner, you know, like I said, you saw him as a rising star, and it just wasn't very good.
What was the problem? It just was they couldn't mesh?
I don't know. It was like a low-energy kind of headlock match.
Oh. Sheep Herders defeated Brad Armstrong and Tim Horner.
Armstrong and Horner, it looks good on paper. They were both good workers. They made sense together, but they just never clicked. Neither of them had a lot of charisma. I never got the Sheep Herders. I just never got them.
The Sheep Herders in context are, first of all, I much prefer it when Boyd's on the team. Boyd adds a little bit of it. You move from goofiness to just straight out intimidation when Jonathan Boyd's on the team. So that's one. And the other is you have to use them right. You have to have some kind of, some bleach blonde baby face team. The Sheep Herders would have been funny if you went to stick them on Douglas and Ace.
That's interesting because they were going to do something along those lines. They had Johnny Ace as their flag bearer, and they were going to use that to turn him, and for whatever reason, it never happened.
But that's how you use them. You have some kind of – and this would be the good way to use them here. You have, the little babyface team. Rock and Roll Express would be great. They had the classic feud against the Fabulous Ones. They had another great feud against the Fantastics, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's
– I just never got into those guys, even as the Bushwhackers, I know, believe it or not.
Oh, no, yeah, it's even worse there. But, if used right, they were fine, I thought. NWA TV champion Nikita Koloff defeated Eddie Gilbert.
This was probably the best match on the show, and all because of Eddie Gilbert. I don't know what it was, but Eddie just had his bumping shoes on. He was, I remember it was a very one-sided match.
This isn't Nikita from 2 years ago.
What do you mean?
I don't. Some of that edge is gone.
Oh yeah, I mean, he's been a babyface now for over a year, and he lost the U.S. title that summer to Lex Luger. And you're right, he was definitely nowhere near as hot as he was. And he was
how
about
much
to leave.
I know the babyface turn was wildly successful when it happened, and it went well, and, great for everybody. How much in the long run do you think that actually hurt Nikita Koloff's career? He was never the same.
No, I think it helped his career. I think that there were circumstances. I mean, right around this time, I think his fiance had cancer, and she did not have long to go. and he got out of the wrestling business, I want to say like January 88 to be by her side. And then when he came back, he was a lot smaller. He was longer like the blown up Russian guy. So, I mean, you know, that's, I'm not going to blame his babyface turn. I think his babyface turn in the long run, I think helped him, but his career went down the tubes for different reasons than that.
You were going in the same place either way.
I kind of think so.
Okay, and that makes sense.
After how many years, you know, the evil Russian guy thing is going to get tired.
Yeah, that's true. Okay, so next up we got the Road Warriors beat Flair and Luger, who was the U.S. Lex in, I'm guessing Lex is in the Four Horsemen at this point.
Lex is in the Four Horsemen, and the next night they were going to shoot the angle that was going to start his babyface turn. I have seen a total of, since Ric Flair started going downhill like 95, 96, and you know the guy at that point was like 45, 46 years old, so of course that's going to happen at some point. During, let's say, from his start in the 70s until, you know, the mid-90s, I saw a total of two bad Ric Flair matches. This is one of them.
Yeah. Where do I even start with this next match? Okay.
I think I know what's coming, but go ahead.
Okay, the next match is War Games. Mm-hmm. Ronnie Garvin, who at the time is NWA World Champion, good use. Dusty Rhodes, Barry Windham, who is the Western States Heritage Champion. I still don't know what that means, but okay. Ricky Morton and Robert Gibson defeated Big Bubba, Anderson and Blanchard, and Eaton and Lane when Eaton submitted to Rhodes' figure four. Okay, I get you want to throw War Games in there, but you need to use these guys. So now looking at this, before I get too far off into that, you're a Northeast. I could say at this point, it is safe to say that you would be an expert on Northeast wrestling. Fair?
Yes. And you know what? Maybe the next show we have, I'm going to demonstrate why I am a pro wrestling expert. That is not conjecture. That is official. But go ahead.
So now as a person, an authority on the Northeast product, how would you book that card if you're coming into town for the first time?
Well, you have to bear this in mind. The next day was Starrcade in Chicago, and they wanted to book a show that was different than Starrcade. They also had a thing going where, I forget the details, but like Ronnie Garvin like wasn't allowed to defend the NWA title like right before Starrcade.
Right before? So, it was like 2 months before.
Yeah. I forget the smarmy details, but they, as soon as they announced Flair versus Garvin rematch at Starrcade, they cut off Ronnie's title matches, which we'll get more into later. But as far as booking the show goes, if you're saying to yourself, look, we want to book something that is different, we want to have fresh opponents, on paper, this show doesn't look too bad. You had Arn and Tully feuding with the Rock and Roll Express. The Rock and Rolls have their longstanding feud with the Midnight Express. You might as well throw Bubba in there. Dusty, of course, is going to be part of the War Games. Barry, you're giving him something to do. I don't think he was feuding with anyone at that point. Oh, that's right. They were building up Barry versus Dr. Death Steve Williams, so you kind of keep both of those guys away from each other.
I don't see how you don't have an NWA title defense here. I know they had the stupid rule. I forgot about the stupid rule. But, and they explained it. I remember I was 12 at the time, and they explained it. And I taped all the shows. I rewinded it, and I listened to it again. I still don't understand what he's talking about. But, yeah, there was some kind of, like, embargo of Ronnie Garvin title defenses for some bizarre reason that just killed him dead.
Well, look at it this way. And, you know, I don't mean to overly defend it. I just understand what they were doing. This is War Games 3 we're looking at, and that's how they were billing the match. You know, come out to Long Island and see War Games 3. War Games 1 and 2, I mean, Ric Flair didn't defend the NWA title. So I guess we're kind of conditioned to, if War Games is on the show, well, you're getting that instead of an NWA title match. But, I mean, War Games was such a hot concept at the time. It was still brand new. They did the first one on July 4th in Atlanta, and then they did one, I want to say, July 30th in Miami. So now you're like, oh, we've got the hot War Games concept coming to New York.
Then the other problem is that you have to have that Valiant team lose. Sorry.
Yeah, and, you know, I guess a lot of us, like a lot of you have probably figured out that I went to this show, and this show, it wasn't just disappointing. It was a bad show. It wasn't just, you know, this was as bad as a Tuesday night in Omaha WWF show.
So how was the War Games match?
It wasn't very good. It was short. I think they did the submission, like, I want to say, like, 5 minutes after, like, the last guy entered the cage. And it was almost like, you know, I compared the NWA. You see, here's the thing. When NWA and WWF were at war, the WWF was pushing, you know, their characters, Hulk Hogan, Randy Savage, Honky Tonk Man. The NWA was pushing, you know, hot in-ring action, and on this night, we were not getting it. It was an absolutely bad show.
Okay, so now you have a crowd of 11,500 here listed. Mm-hmm. Does that sound accurate?
Yes, it does. It was not completely full, but there were a lot of seats were taken.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, there were very few empty seats, is what I'm trying to say.
For the NASCAR Coliseum at the time, I think that's around 2/3.
Ooh, I don't have it in my head. I think there were around 14,000. And if I recall correctly, like only the arena was like oval shaped, and only like the seats really far away on both sides of that oval were empty.
How was the crowd?
The crowd was, I mean, everyone was excited for a lot of people. It was their first live NWA show. And if I recall, you know, once again, if I recall correctly, there was a general sense of disappointment that the War Games wasn't better, that the Flair and Luger against the Road Warriors match wasn't better, which, by the way, I mean, sounds good coming in, both from a Mark and a Smart fan point of view. It's like, you know, wow, Ric Flair and Lex Luger, the two top heels against these, you know, mighty Road Warriors guys who never lose.
Sure. Okay, we go on to Thanksgiving.
Well, let me throw this in, too, just as a personal thing. Like I said, we mm-hmm. left at 10 in the morning. The show got over, I want to say, around 10:30. It took us an hour and a half to get out of the parking lot. We did not get home until 5:30. So we left at like 11 and got home the next day at 5:30 to see a pretty awful wrestling show.
Which would be Survivor Series 87.
Yep. Now, this we watched at my place. I did not go to a Thanksgiving party on this night, but we had a bunch of people over to see it on pay-per-view. So this is the second crazy wrestling night.
I hate the Survivor Series. I do. It's a little gimmicky little thing that has no emotion or meaning or anything. It's something that would fit in perfectly right now, but I can't stand the Survivor Series. Anyway, So the what we have here is this took place in Richfield, Ohio, November 26th, and you have a sellout, 21,000, which tells you all you need to know.
Yep.
Thanksgiving night, and Randy Savage with Miss Elizabeth, Jim Duggan, Jake Roberts, Ricky Steamboat, and Brutus Beefcake defeated the IC champion, the Honky Tonk Man with Jimmy Hart, Harley Race with Heenan, Davis, Hercules, and Ron Bass.
Now, this was probably, I mean, do I have this right? Were there four total Survivor Series matches?
Yes.
Okay, so this is basically the second tier of the singles guys, and the focus on this match was Randy Savage against the Honky Tonk Man. I thought it was a good match.
There's no drama to the contest. There's nothing to gain from it. I'd rather have a title match. And where did this concept come from? Whose great idea was this?
It was, you know what? I really don't know whose concept it was, but I mean, we all know the story. I mean, off the success of the first WrestleMania, Vince decides to have a Thanksgiving show on the, you know, on the same day that Crockett is having his show. And this, I mean, I've always said, you know, if this was Crockett wasn't doing well, but this was like the gunshot wound to the stomach for him, because he was counting on Starrcade bringing him in a lot of money, and Vince killed it dead. So that was the whole concept behind the show. Like, hey, let's put something out there. But I thought it was a neat concept. I really did. It was like, you know, an all-star team of the top WWF singles. Then you had the second tier, which is this match, and then the other two matches that we'll talk about.
Yeah, but the problem is that there's nothing to be gained by winning it, really. I mean, I get, okay, bragging rights, whatever. Yeah, I'm sure that gets far. But, I mean, it doesn't really matter. I guess I see it for like one match, but a card of it, I don't know. And my other problem with it, it's great to cover guys who stink. Like if you have Andre and Andre's losing it and you want to throw him in one of these matches, perfect. They did that for years. This next match is my problem. Fabulous Moolah, Velvet McIntyre, Rockin' Robin, and the Jumping Bomb Angels defeated Sensational Sherry, Leilani Kai, Judy Martin, Dawn Marie, and Donna Cristinello.
Mm-hmm.
Why can't I just watch a Sensational Sherry, Donna Cristinello versus the Jumping Bomb Angels match? I would much rather see that.
Because it's the Survivor Series, dude. That's the concept.
Yes, but all these other people are weighing down the good workers in here.
Okay, two things. It was at this – you got to remember, this is the first time anything like this had been done before. So it was a novelty that wasn't even beginning to wear off. It sounded cool coming in. I'm going to ask everyone, and we haven't talked about this yet. If you enjoy this podcast, by all means, visit our Stick to Wrestling Facebook page. And my question to everyone out there, we're talking United States and Canada only. Mexico does not count, and Japan certainly does not count. Was there a better women's match before this one? Because this match was an all-timer. I don't know when the last time you saw this match was, Sean. This was like a 4-star match.
Yeah, why?
Why? Because, I mean, Moolah kept up her part. I think a big reason is because when you have 10 people in there, you can keep everyone fresh and moving.
And the Jumping Bomb Angels just showed up, and they basically lit a fire under everyone's ass in that division. They are awesome. The women's division in the WWF, whatever, has been so bad for so long.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, these two show up. And it's like, you just inherently thought women's wrestling was going to be terrible. And then you see these two, the Jumping Bomb Angels, come in, and it's like, oh my God, these guys are fantastic. Every match they were in was 4 stars.
You know what? I have more of a feeling that it was Moolah, believe it or not, who lit a fire under everybody and said, hey, you know, this is going to be our night to shine. Once again, just guessing, but the, you know, Jumping Bomb Angels didn't have any kind of pull in that locker room by this point.
I understand that, but if Moolah brings in her usual act into the thing, and the Jumping Bomb Angels just do what they do. Now, I'm not saying their influence, I'm saying their presence, if they look so much better than everybody else, they're going to make them look like idiots. They're that much better normally than the rest of the crew usually is. So just to keep up with them so they look as good, or, you know, they have to bring their A game so they get embarrassed.
I mean, maybe. I don't know. I'm more inclined to think that, you know, all Moolah and all the girls just said, hey, let's have an unbelievable match. I mean, even Donna Cristinello, who was had to be at least 40 by this point, was holding up her end. It was an excellent match.
I actually like Donna. I'm looking at this match. There are a lot of people here I actually don't mind. Velvet McIntyre, I've always been a fan of. Bomb Angels are awesome. Sherry's fantastic. Leilani, whatever with those two. And yeah, Donna I was fine with too. Who's Dawn Marie?
Oh, she was just like an undercard girl that, you know, sometimes was filler on an arena show, or she did some TV. She was, you know, kind of a no big deal, but again, she did a good job.
As a point of clarification, this is not the same woman from ECW.
No, it is not. Thank you for bringing that up.
Okay, so our next match is the tag team champions, Tito Santana and Rick Martel. That is the
Strikeforce.
Okay. And Davey, okay, so we have Strikeforce. We have the Bulldogs. Was Strikeforce and the Bulldogs ever in a match together?
I don't believe so, except this match.
That'd be a great match. And the Rougeaux, oh, good Lord, look at this. The Rougeaux, the Powers and Roma, and Blair and Brunzel defeated Hart and Neidhart, the Islanders, Nikolai Volkoff and Boris Zhukov, Demolition, Dino Bravo, and Greg Valentine. So here you have the Rougeaux are faces? When did this happen?
Oh, they came in as baby faces, I want to say spring, summer of 1986, and they turned them summer of 88.
How was this match? This just looks...
It was excellent.
Really?
It was really good. And I remember watching it live and just being like, you know, oh my God, is this show going to be better than Starrcade? And we'll get more into that in a minute. But it was just – it was an excellent match. I would say, once again, like 3.5, 3.75 stars.
When I see this match, it's almost like looking at the Golden State Warriors on paper. Because it looks great, but it's – you're sitting there wondering, how many balls can you get? It's just – there's so much star power involved that you still have to kind of still coordinate that somehow.
Yeah,
it almost looks
you're
like it's just like – crazy. So the way the tag team matches worked is if one member of the tag team is pinned, the whole tag team's out, right?
Exactly.
Okay. Now, for those who – I may be dating myself to the way these old matches were, but assuming all you guys know it. But just in case they don't, a quick refresher. It's a five-on-five team. There's one captain of each, and it's basically from then on it's an elimination match. So you could end up with a three-on-one or a five-on-one, which happily tells you before every match.
Yep, and they emphasize that building up to the event, mm-hmm. that, you know, it could be you could have Honky Tonk Man in there 4-on-1 with Savage and his buddies, which I think it didn't that kind of happen.
It never works out exactly the way Gorilla describes it, but yeah, something like that did happen. I think Honky took like a count out or something.
Yeah, he did.
And your main event for the evening is Andre, Rick Rude, King Kong Bundy, Butch Reed, and the One Man Gang defeated the Hulkster, Bigelow, Orndorff, Patera, and Morocco. How much is the Andre Hogan thing still working here?
It is still red hot. Also, want to throw in that Don Morocco was a not a last-minute substitution, but a substitution for superstar Billy Graham, who just completely hit the wall. He could not go anymore, and Morocco came in as Graham's protege. The build-up, here's the thing. WrestleMania 3, you had the dream match, Hogan and Andre. This isn't Hogan-Andre 2, but it's kind of Hogan-Andre 1A. That's how they promoted it coming in, and it was Andre's first match since WrestleMania 3, and we didn't see him until this match started building up, but his name came up often, and I want to say late September he came back on TV, and they started doing the build-up for this match. But this match brings out like the 10-year-old, 12-year-old wrestling fan in me, because as you compared, you know, you mentioned the Golden State Warriors, this really was like an all-star team against an all-star team. I mean, without Savage and Honky Tonk Man, I mean, you're looking at the top five heels against the top five baby faces.
I just can't wrap my mind around Patera and Hogan being on the same team. Or Morocco too, for that matter. Morocco is a face. It's just ugh. But why did Hogan's team lose here?
I forget the details. I watched this maybe a year or a year and a half ago again, And I couldn't believe how good it was. And I remember thinking it was really good when I watched it live. But I don't remember the finish. And I probably would have done all you guys a big favor by at least reviewing this particular event before I got on the horn. Sorry about that.
I mean,
but whatever. It's not WWE Network. It's not like a big secret.
Well, I kind of wanted your memories for it anyway, so that works. We're looking for what was going on back then. And, we all make fun of Hulk and everything like that. But if you were back then, you have to understand there was a certain energy to all of Hulk's matches. Even the ones that were bad, there was a certain energy to it just because it was him.
Yeah, and he had only been around for, like, you know, at this point, 3.5 years, a little bit more than that. And he was still red hot.
Yeah, he was still – this was still in the middle of his first run, right?
Yes. And he had not lost the title yet.
Yeah, it was a 4-year run, which at that point is just forever. I can grasp the idea of Bruno as champion for 8 years more than I can picture Hogan champion for 4 in that era. Because that was the time when the belt was starting to move fast.
They were starting to move faster. I mean, Bob Backlund was champion for, just under 6 years. And I was tired of him being champion by the time he lost the belt. Harley Race had been champion for like 3 years when he, no, 4 years when he finally lost the belt in 81. I felt like he had been champion forever. Hogan, 3.5 years into it, it never felt like, okay, something needs to change. It's just getting old.
Yeah, no, it almost looked like they booked themselves out of it. It was like the reason he left was Hogan had some other thing deal on the side or something. He had the TV show or something going on.
He was making a movie in 88.
So, but yeah, it's just the way they seemed to book the whole thing. End up like they couldn't get out of their own way because that machine didn't seem like it was slowing down anytime soon.
No, and I think Andre's team, and it was booked as Andre's team, by the way, Andre's team against Hogan's team. It made total sense to put Andre over because, I mean, obviously, Andre lost clean at WrestleMania. He needs a little something to get his heat back, and they knew he was going to be a big part of WrestleMania 4 at this point.
Okay, so what else happened? What did you guys do for the evening after the card was over? What was your reaction to the show watching it live?
It was a very positive reaction from both. You know, I mean, we were all kind of smart at that point, but everyone liked the show. Now, the next show we're going to talk about, let me explain what happened. Anytime someone says something negative about Dave Meltzer, I don't like it, okay? I think it's all nitpicking. And Dave is a really good guy. He really, really is. What Dave did for me, he lives in San Jose. And he was one of the four his cable company was one of the four in the country that was carrying the Starrcade 87. The next day, so we're talking the Friday after Thanksgiving, he's getting on a plane and he's flying to Japan. But before he does that, he's nice enough to overnight a copy of Starrcade 87 to me so that we had it on Saturday night to watch.
That's a good friend right there.
Well, I mean, I sent him the money to do it. Don't get me wrong, but I mean, you know, like I said, he was, you know, what a guy. And I'd never met him at that point before. We'd been on the phone, but that's it.
Oh, so anyway, send me up here. Well, first of all, let's get the ambiance at Casa del McAdam over there. So, how you watch this? You got the buddies over?
Yes, I had my wrestling pals over, and it had already been a crazy wrestling weekend. I mean, the long trip on Wednesday, Survivor Series on Thursday. Friday, we took the day off from wrestling. We wound up spending the day in Boston. And then Saturday, this tape comes in, and we're having a tape party, Starrcade tape party at like 8 o'clock, and then Saturday night's main event at 11:30.
Guys are crazy. That is a lot of wrestling, my friend. So let's see.
A lot of wrestling, 4 days.
So they are at the UIC Pavilion, really. Well, okay, first of all, where to start with this being in the UIC Pavilion? How dumb was this?
I don't know. I see both sides of it. From what I understand, they really pissed off the fans in Greensboro by doing this. At the same time, you are no longer Mid-Atlantic Championship Wrestling. You are at least trying to be a national company. And I can see wanting to have the event in a big city like Chicago, third biggest city in the country. So I see both sides of it.
Yeah, but at the UIC?
I'll you know what? I am guessing here, but I'll bet the WWF had a lock on whatever arena in Chicago the Bulls were using.
Then that makes whatever they're doing even dumber. Because, I mean, I understand if you're going to Chicago Stadium and you're getting Chicago Stadium, fine. You're coming up to Chicago, alienating your own fans who've been there for you since 1967 for this event, just to have it here for a crowd of 8,000. You put this in Greensboro, how much are you there?
You would definitely make more from the live gate. Especially if you did what they had done the previous 2 years, which is to have half of it in Greensboro and half of it in Atlanta. So they probably cut their attendance gate by half, not even by half, probably by more like 60-65%. But at the same time, how much is that image of being a national company versus being a regional company worth? I don't have the answer. That's why I'm saying I see both sides of the story.
Oh, I have the answer. Where are they now?
For more reasons than just that, they are a distant memory.
Well, the JCP portion of this franchise was about to end within about 12 months. So
no, we are obviously didn't work almost out well. 30 years away from the exact date of JCP being sold to WTBS. Or Turner
okay.
Home Entertainment.
So let's look at the product they're rolling out for the fine fans in Chicago.
Yeah.
Okay. We have Ross and Schiavone. Why do we have to have Ross and Schiavone? They're the same guy again. They fill the same role. Ross is better at it.
I you know what? I said that from the front from day one when they bought Mid-South and they had Ross on TBS. You know, I think a three-man booth is one man too much, especially in wrestling.
Okay, and you have a backstage segment. I know you love Missy, but I hate these segments. And she welcomed the fan to talk about the upcoming bouts. And then also the great Bob Caudill, because, you know, you have Bob Caudill there. Why isn't Bob Caudill just doing the play-by-play?
I don't know. If it were me running the show, it would be Jim Ross and Bob Caudill. No. And I know they both kind of play the same role, but I'd be fine with that.
Yeah, I can live with that because Caudill's just that awesome. So he was conducting a backstage interview. Okay, so they were doing this stuff now. So you're really starting to get the feel of like a modern day pay-per-view where it's not like here is your events, but you have the vignettes and all the other stuff that goes with it now.
Exactly. And by the way, you know, I'm sure you guys know, this is JCP's first pay-per-view. And they had a lot of eggs put in that basket, and Vince just threw the basket down the stairs.
Okay, so there's a whole lot of talking going on here that I can't be bothered with, so I'm just going to skip by that. Tag team champions Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard keep the belts against the Road Warriors earlier in the show. What does that
mean? They had that as the first match on the show. The idea was, A, have a hot opening match, and B, I think we talked about this last week. They have this thing where if you're not, they had this rule where someone calls and they're like, I don't like this pay-per-view. Can we please turn it off? Like 15 minutes into it, they can do that. So they're trying to convince you not to do that.
Oh, I forgot about that. You're right. Yeah, they used to have, they used to be, they did a thing where what was it? It wasn't that. No, you know what it was? They would leave the thing open for like the first 10 minutes. So you could watch the first 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then it would click off. So
and
basically,
you got hooked. You ordered it, right?
Exactly. So that's what they were going for. So, yeah, I remember that because all the. I'll forget. I think I've seen pretty much the first 10 minutes of every pay per view ever.
Sean, let me ask you something. Now, this match ended on a disqualification. So is that right? The Road Warriors won, but on a DQ?
It doesn't even say that. It just said they kept the belt. So yeah, I'm guessing since they kept the belts, it was a DQ. Plus, did they ever pin anybody?
Oh, no. I mean, but my question was, I mean, you have the Road Warriors, who at least storyline-wise are from Chicago. Why not, in the opener, have them win the belts and make the local crowd happy and set the stage for the rest of the night?
Because this has been one of the great controversies forever. It was pretty – how much did everyone think the Road Warriors are going over here?
If you're the average fan watching, you're thinking this is their night. It's Starrcade, biggest show of the year, and they have the home field advantage. And as far as like people, like newsletter people, a lot of us thought the belts were changing hands.
It was like when Flair for the Gold at Starrcade 83. The way they kept building up to the show, they're like, oh, it's the Road Warriors night, obviously.
Yeah,
you know, they kept patiently looking, you know, and then, you know, it was almost like they outthought themselves here. You know, they made it seem like so much, they made it seem so obvious that the Road Warriors were going to win that they wanted to be cute about it. And this really probably wasn't the match to do it.
The only explanation that I can even offer, and I don't even agree with this, is back then the Road Warriors did not do jobs. Argument A is, okay, how are we going to get the belts off of them? Argument B is the Road Warriors may have been too big stars to just have the tag team titles. But again, the counter to that is that would get your tag team titles even more over. So I thought what they did was really dumb.
Again, that's it, because if you do it the other way, you end up what you were seeing in New York back in the 70s, where you end up devaluing your belts so much that they were pretty much worthless by, you know, 75, 76, 77. Until the Samoans came in.
Yeah, and by this point, too, I think the fans in every NWA city, and by the way, attendance was already on the way down, they were getting sick of the Dusty's cheap finishes.
As were we all.
And what was number two? The six man?
And let's see, the second match coming in is, oh yes, the team of Hayes, Garvin, and Sting against Gilbert, Steiner, and Zbyszko. Okay. It was a 15-minute time limit draw. The match ended as Hayes had Gilbert covered with a sunset flip. After the match, the crowd chanted, "Eddie sucks at Gilbert."
This was clearly who else do we want to have? Do we want to give a Starrcade payoff to that we have nothing else to do with, and they just threw these guys all in there?
I'm going to read this match. I'm going to say this sounds awesome, and you're going to tell me how disappointed you were. Okay. UWF champion Steve Williams pinned Worcester State Heritage champion Barry Windham at 6:51 with an Oklahoma side roll. As an injured Windham re-entered the ring, only Williams' title was at stake. The crowd booed during the match and for the finish.
Yeah, this was supposed to be the start of a Dr. Death heel turn, which, by the way, I think would have made sense. But Dr. Death was gone pretty quickly after this. He decided to stick with Japan, and he came back at the March 1988 Clash of the Champions and as a babyface.
What was Dr. Death missing?
A manager.
Because everybody who ever saw, he got one push after another, and they even did the Brawl for All for him, and they messed that up.
That's right. Poor Doc. That was such an awful night for him. He got knocked out cold standing up and tore his hamstring on the way down.
By one of the smoking guns.
Yeah, by Bart, I forget his real name, Bart, but Bart Gunn, who was a legit tough guy. And you know, by the time the Brawl for All came around, I mean, Doc was what, 36, 37? I mean, hey.
It's still has anybody ever botched more pushes?
No. And the thing was, to this day in the United States, I still think Dr. Death Steve Williams was pushable. Just no one pushed him correctly. Put Jim Cornette behind Steve Williams and see what happens.
And now they ruin a perfectly good Ricky Robert versus the Midnight's match by slapping them on a scaffold.
And they had just done the scaffold match the year before, so it's not like anyone's going to get overly excited by that. And you're right, they ruined what could have been a desperately needed good match on this show. As if you can't tell, I didn't like this show either. But yeah, I mean, it was... There was just no reason to put those guys up on a scaffold. They didn't even have a hot feud. The Rock and Rolls were feuding with Tully and Arn.
Is okay. So it mentions here that Lane that Stan got injured here. It appeared he got injured. Was he hurt?
I don't know. But I'll tell you. I mean, any time you're taking a bump off that scaffold, even if you're, you know, they do the thing where you're hanging off it, you're extending your arms, okay, one, two, three, drop. I've never seen any other scaffold drop, nor should I. But, you know, it's easy to see a guy, I mean, Cornette completely blew out his knee from that thing the year before. His knee has never been the same.
Yeah, Big Bubba dropped him. Yeah, Cornette fell, and the whole idea was that Bubba was going to catch him.
How is Bubba Rogers, and he was a huge guy, going to catch Jim Cornette from that friggin' height from that fall? I know that's what was supposed to happen, but whose idea is this?
It's, the whole match is a bad idea, because every scaffold match that's not involving Bill Dundee, who's the only person who should ever be involved in a scaffold match, is they both crawl to the center, they throw punches, one slips, and it turns into that scene from Star Wars where Luke and Darth Vader are having the sword fight. Luke's like hanging on to the, you know, they're cutting off his hand and stuff. Mm-hmm. It turns into, we relive that. And that's every match. That's every scaffold match, except for the ones that Bill Dundee are in. Actually, have you ever seen... God, I'm sorry.
Oh, I've seen the Bill Dundee Coca Ware match, and Bill Dundee's fearless up there. But here's another thing. I've often stated, and if you've listened to this show, you've heard me say this, like, it's more important to get someone in the building imagining they're going to see something unbelievable than having them show up anyway and having a four-star match. You want to get him in the building. But now, last year, we already saw the scaffold match. They sold us the videotape, so we know it stinks, and our imaginations are no longer at work here. So it was just a bad idea.
Have you ever heard the story of the first scaffold match?
It was in Memphis.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't Dundee. Who was it?
No, it's actually available. I've seen it. There's a collection of 70s stuff out there on YouTube, but the match is available. It is Don Green. Again, I believe it's Don Green.
It was Don Green. That's the one name I know.
Don Green against Jerry Jarrett.
Okay. All right. I remember Don Green.
Putting your money where your mouth is, basically. Jerry's like, you know, if we're going to have this crazy match, I'm going to do it. And here was the weird thing. The scaffold wasn't as high as you would usually, you know, it wasn't the 20-foot high scaffold. But what they did was they kept falling until someone couldn't continue. So it was like some kind of an Iron Man match almost. Like one of the guys would fall, they'd get back up. It was like, it was a Texas death match kind of rule.
That's insane.
Yeah. Oh, it's crazy.
Oh,
but
man.
It wasn't as high up, but yeah, that was the original one. And it was a little more entertaining than usually, but it's just a bad match overall. And to waste on the four, it's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Nikita again against Terry Taylor in the unification match for they're unified in the TV and the TV championships with the UWF and the NWA.
Now the build-up for this match was so incredibly one-sided on Nikita Koloff's part. They made it look like Terry Taylor had no chance against this guy, that I went against common logic and just figured that, okay, they're going to do the switch. Somehow Eddie Gilbert's going to interfere and Terry Taylor's going to walk off with two titles. Nope. Terry Taylor was not, both Eddie Gilbert and Terry Taylor were going to be out of that company very soon. Very soon, probably like 3 or 4 weeks later.
Because what you just said is a smart move. Is you build up Nikita and then have Terry's coming out party and have him, like, you know, have this great win. And, you know, I think you could have worked with that. And I think he would have been a fine heel.
Oh yeah, same here. I think it would have worked, but again, you know, Dusty liked Nikita, and he did not like Terry Taylor. And end of story.
Okay, so we have the tag team match. The NWA Tag Team Champions, Arn Anderson and Tully Blanchard, defeated the Road Warriors via reverse decision, or otherwise known as
the Dusty Finish.
Yes.
And you see, Dusty, at this point, he still doesn't get it. He thinks the fans are going to get mad at the rules or, you know, oh, gosh, these guys just can't get a break. But no, they get mad. At this point, they're getting mad at the promotion.
Well, let's see what Dusty, check the fine print, Rhodes came up with this time. The challengers originally won the match and titles at 13:24 when Road Warrior Animal pinned Anderson following the Doomsday Device, but referee Tommy Young overruled Earl Hebner's decision since he saw Animal throw Anderson over the top moments before the pinfall. Mind your own damn business, Tommy.
Yeah, God, really.
You know, the one guy you would think who would do this is Tommy Young. But, you know, never saw a camera he didn't love. So Tommy, so basically, Tommy Young noticed this. Okay. Who does this?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, in theory, he's just doing his job, and that's when the match should have ended. But again, Dusty, the fans aren't getting mad at the referee. They're getting mad at the promotion. And you know what? We talked about this match earlier. I'm like, wow, that was the opener? I don't remember that. I remember the six-man being the opener. But yeah, it wasn't.
It's the equivalent of Dean Blandino running onto Gillette Field and saying he noticed something 22 minutes ago and he wanted to, you know. You could tell he's stretching to try to figure out new ones by now.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, and by this point, I want to get ahead of myself, but there were rumblings in the newsletters. Like, it looks like Dusty's run has ended. And after this show, like, people, the smart fans just wanted Dusty's blood. They wanted him out.
And the last match we have, of course, Dusty pinning NWA US champion Lex Luger in a steel cage match to win the title at 16:24. There was celebration. Oh, there's one more. I'm sorry. I didn't see the one at the bottom. Yeah. But of course,
Let's talk about that match for a minute. The original plan was, now the stipulation in this match was, if Dusty wins, he wins the United States title. If Luger wins, Dusty is suspended or is out of the NWA for 120 days. They were
Get me Uvalde Slim math, Greta.
Oh, I mean, he got it ready anyway. He was going to be the Midnight Rider, and they were going to do something. I believe they were going to do it at the upcoming Long Island Coliseum pay-per-view in late January, where Dusty, as the Midnight Rider, was going to pin Ric Flair for the NWA title. And they're going to do the same thing they did in Florida, where Dusty, as Midnight Rider, couldn't be unmasked, couldn't go in the back and just have someone verify his identity because he's not supposed to be there, and hand the title over. Same thing he did in 1982 in Florida. And supposedly, I know that was the plan, Luger was going to remain heel until he turned right before the 1988 Great American Bash. And from what I've heard, Jim Crockett had a meeting with Dusty and said, Dusty, we can't hold off on anything anymore. We need to hotshot everything. We need to turn Luger now. We need to redo the Midnight Rider now. So, but that was the plan coming in.
And the final match is, of course, Ric Flair finally ending poor Ronnie Garvin's misery and winning back the belt in the steel cage, which was, if memory serves, was a pretty good match, even though you can openly hear the crowd booing and cheering for Flair.
Yes, and booing Garvin, cheering for Flair. It was a good but not great match. After, you know, and let's be honest, this was a pretty miserable show. And just like the night before, it wasn't just disappointing, it was bad. And this match needed to be the match that saved it. It was good. It was probably like 3.75 stars, but it was not good enough to make up for the rest of the night.
It wasn't as good as the Detroit match.
No, and the Detroit match was good.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, to me, the idea, I mean, it's 31 years later. What else can I say about it? It was such a bad idea to make Ronnie Garvin the NWA champion. I respect Garvin, but he just, you know, the other side has Hulk Hogan.
It wasn't a bad idea for a quick run if they didn't weren't stupid about it. And if they were going to give Ronnie a run, it should have been the year before.
Nah, they shouldn't have given it to him anyway. I mean, the other side has Hulk Hogan. You've got Ric Flair standing right there, and you're going with Ronnie Garvin, who the most prestigious title he had held in that company was the National Heavyweight Championship, which he lost 2 years ago. Yep. I thought it was an unbelievably bad move. And even the densest mark in the house. I think I've asked you this before, but in 1989. I think it was the Miller Brewing Company did a survey of 1,000 sports fans. And one of the questions was, do you think pro wrestling is real? Please guess how many fans out of that 1,000 said yes.
Do I think pro wrestling is real? I will say out of 1,000, I'll say 350.
How about zero?
Really?
It was zero. 1,000 out of 1,000 sports fans polled said that they did not believe that pro wrestling was real. So I don't think the people in the crowd, 99% of them, or maybe 95, don't think it's real. Don't think it's real. And they all, I think the densest mark in the crowd knew that the whole purpose of putting the title on Ron Garvin was to take it off of him at Starrcade. And so that they could have Ric Flair win the belt again.
Oh, that's fair enough. I do think it was a year yet late. I think it was, you know, in that way it was a mistake. So that's fair enough. I just don't want to get on Ron about it because it was just handled so badly.
I agree with that. You know, you put Garvin in a situation that, you know, you buy him a pair of shoes that are too big. Well, it's not his fault. Our good friend, Jeff Bowdrin, who lives under the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network umbrella, came up with the best idea once this was already rolling, and this was in The Observer, where Ron Garvin, once he gets the belt, kind of forgets that he's Ron Garvin, the working class guy, and becomes more and more like Ric Flair. And then finally, the Horsemen kick Ric Flair out and bring in the new NWA champion, Ron Garvin, into the fold. And then Ric Flair trains with Magnum TA before Starrcade, and he regains the belt as a babyface.
Yep.
That would have worked. But anyway, we are out of time. We were going to briefly discuss the Saturday night's main event show, which we watched at my house after we watched Starrcade 87. But it was just a typical SNME with Hogan going over King Kong Bundy. But anyway, Sean, thank you very much for participating, man. I really appreciate it.
Happy Thanksgiving, man.
Everyone have a happy Thanksgiving. Thank you for listening. And this has been a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. Go Vols, be dandy.